Hello, everyone. I'm Sam.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Mo.
And this is Team Get Over It.
We're an all-female team participating in the greatest motoring adventure on the planet, the Mongol Rally.
We'll be driving 10,000 miles across mountains, deserts, and unknown terrain.
And along the way, we hope to spread our feminist and environmental ideals.
Join us here as we share our stories, thoughts, and interviews as we get ready for the Mongol Rally 2021.
Don't you mean 2022?
Shit!
Hello!
Hey!
Welcome back and thanks for tuning in. We have a special and familiar guest joining us today for this episode, which we are so excited for.
That's right. It's been a while since we've all been together like this. Today, we would like to welcome Sam back to the show.
Woo!
Thanks for having me.
So, Sam, how you been? Can you tell the listeners a little bit of what you've been up to lately?
Yeah. So, first off, it's lovely to be back here with the two of you.
Oh. Of course.
What have I been up to? I have been applying to grad schools again. So for any longtime listeners, you know it's been like a long journey, but it's a journey that is finally coming to an end. I have some grad schools in sight. No decisions have been made yet, but exciting things in the future. I'm starting a new job. I'm swimming, potentially joining a hiking group.
Ooh.
You know, living my best life. I don't know what else to update, but yeah, that's what I've been up to lately.
Well, we're glad to have you back, and you have something really interesting and important to share with us today, right?
That's right. So today I want to talk about Bill Gates' book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. Specifically, I want to explore his 5 questions he suggests to ask about any and all climate change solutions. Mm.
And for the record, neither Mo nor I have read this book, though we did do a little background reading before this episode. So Sam really has the podium on this one.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it. Bill Gates has been a hot topic for a while, and I know this was much anticipated. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about it.
All right. Well, don't worry. You don't need to have any background with the book to participate or enjoy listening to this podcast episode.
Perfect.
So I'll jump right into it. So I read this book in 2021, and within really a few pages, I could tell that it was going to be a game changer of a book, both for me personally, but I think also for everyone working in or just generally interested in the climate sector. But to give a little background information real quickly before we dive into the meat of this episode, the book I'm talking about and the book we'll be referring to throughout this podcast is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, which Bill Gates published last year. The essential premise of this book is that Gates outlines what we would need to do as a society to get our global carbon emissions from 51 billion a year to net zero.
Ooh.
Wow.
It's a tall order.
Tall order. Yeah, there's an entire chapter called This Won't Be Easy.
China. I'm sorry.
Oh, let's not point fingers.
I took it back. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But the word net is key in that phrase because Bill Gates submits, and I actually agree with him on this, that our goal shouldn't be working towards producing absolutely no carbon emissions at all because mm-hmm. that's just not realistic or feasible. Mm-hmm. But we should be working towards, one, reducing the number of emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere, and two, then finding a way to capture or remove the emissions that we are releasing so that mathematically we get to a net zero emissions.
Mm-hmm. That seems more reasonable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we breathe, so.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think it's just like a more realistic approach, right? And it feels like a more feasible approach to, like, I mean, you're never going to convince the entire world to, like, stop everything that produces emission. I mean, right. Making cement produces emission. Like, what are you going to do? Just tell the world, like, no more cement? Like, it's not going to happen. So we have to find a way to, like, balance it out, mathematically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so throughout this book, Bill Gates creates almost a roadmap of how we can do this net zero or get to this net zero. So the chapters are titled things like how we plug in, how we make things, how we grow things. And in each category, he basically walks you through what technology we already have, what we need to develop, what we've already maxed out on innovation-wise, and what the government should subsidize to get us to zero emissions.
Mm. Oh, wow. So
it's really interesting. Highly recommend to anyone. Probably one of the most illuminating books I've read, definitely in the past few years, maybe in my lifetime. And it's kind of a book I just like wanted to like send to like every politician, right? Because I was just like, I was just like, read this and then create policy like off of it. It's like one of those like books.
It seems like it's a very succinct and easy to follow step-by-step guide on like, you know, how to do this. So you're exactly right. Like, I wonder if people are trying to implement some of the changes that he's suggesting or if they've just completely ignored it. Because it seems like it's pretty simple.
I kind of want him to do like, you know, like 5 years in the future, like what's been done after he publishes his book, because I'm curious, because I think actually there's like something in this book that I know innovation has, like, I guess there has been innovation in the sector past what this book talks about. So, and I'll get, like, I'll give you a sneak peek of it later in the episode. But yeah, so that's the premise of the book. Let's get into what we're actually going to talk about today. So the focus of this particular podcast episode is actually just one chapter in the book, which is titled Five Questions to Ask in Every Climate Conversation. And I found this chapter so incredibly useful, and I've revisited it countless times in the past year. So I thought, let's talk about it, let's dive into it, and let's get to know these questions, because they really help put, I think, climate conversations into perspective. So, let's do it. Okay. So I don't know about you guys, but I feel like almost every day I'm reading like some article or another about like a fix or a solution that someone has come up with that could help fight the climate change. Yeah. Do you experience this?
Yeah, and some of them seem more feasible than others and some less feasible.
Yeah, exactly. And so like seeing like, you know, like all of these articles, like it's awesome because like one, like I love that people are talking about it so much. And like two, I love how many people are looking for a solution. But like when you see so many ideas and you're looking at articles that talk about cars that run on air and plant-based diets that can save the ozone, it can kind of be overwhelming figuring out like which of these ideas, like you talked about, like are feasible and which of them hold real value and could make a meaningful impact in like the grand scheme of things.
Right.
And so that's what these questions that Bill Gates sort of like, you know, prepares for us are meant to address. He sets up five simple questions that you can ask anytime you're reading one of these articles or hearing about, you know, one of these climate solutions, maybe like a politician talking or like a friend like at a barbecue. And you can use these questions basically to figure out which of these ideas are worth pursuing. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to go through each of these questions one by one, learn about them, and then put them into practice. I'm going to let you guys practice the questions, if you will.
Oh my god, I love it.
Oh no,
it.
Teacher, there's homework? Crap.
It's practice. Not homework. It's more like classwork because we're doing it together, Mo. Don't worry.
I love it.
It's okay. Ungraded participation.
My favorite credit. Kind of work. Yeah.
I know, exactly. Ungraded participation only. Perfect. I just have to raise my hand.
Yes, exactly. So are you both ready?
Yes. Should
we dive
I'm ready.
Into this?
Maybe.
Mo's like, I don't know.
Hey man, it was a
this
long
sounds
day.
Like a I lot of like up, thinking bro. Brain power for like a Friday like evening for you. You're like, I'm ready like, for the weekend like to start.
Crack of dawn on Saturday morning for me, and I'm rearing and ready to go.
I'm ready. I'm just, you know, I'm a little tired because we're moving into the new house. It's been 4 days.
That's
of
totally
living.
Okay, well, let's get into it. So the first question that you can ask in any climate conversation is, how much of the 51 billion tons are we talking about? So this question is really useful when you're reading an article that says something like, such and such solution will reduce carbon emissions by X tons a year. Oftentimes the number they say sounds so big, especially when you have no context to put it into, which is unfortunately often the case in these articles.
Yeah.
And when you hear that something is going to reduce the emissions by like 4 million tons a year, you're like, wow, that's awesome. but in reality, like, how much is that, right? So that's what this question does. It helps put those numbers into context. So whenever you see a statement like that, you can ask, okay, how much of the 51 billion tons are we talking about? And look at it like a percentage rather than some number with no context.
Right.
In the books, Bill Gates states, to me, this makes more sense than the other comparisons you often see, like this many tons is equivalent to taking one car off the road. Who knows how many cars are on the road to begin with, or how many cars we would have to take off the road to deal with climate change.
Right.
Yeah, right. And I remember reading that and being like, yes, yes, sir. Because I think that's, it's a common comparison, and I think it, like, it's a nice image. Like, this is, like, taking one car off the road, but, like, really, like, do any of us know how many cars we would need to take off the road to fight climate change?
It's a lot. They give you half of the equation, but not enough information to actually solve the problem when they're giving you those, like, statements or comparisons.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas to me, whenever I see those numbers, it just screams. I don't know if either of you ever read the book How to Lie with Statistics.
No, I've never read that, but it makes sense.
But yep. it's like they're giving you a number and they're like, wow, this is so big. But in reality, maybe it's like 0.0001% of like total emissions, right? And you're like, oh, like, is that really worth pursuing?
Right.
And so I think this question really helps us figure out which ideas are going to create the most change and which we should be funneling our time, money, and effort into, because, you know, like we've talked about on this podcast, we don't have much time left.
That's the way the world's going.
Yeah, we need to be focusing on the ideas that are going to do the most. But let's look at this in practice. I'm going to send both of you a quick sentence from an article reference in the book. I will put it in the chat, and can one of you read it for me?
Oh, Zencaster chat. Oh my God.
Zencaster chat.
I was like, Facebook? Oh, okay. So what does it say? An emissions trading program in Europe reduced the carbon footprint for the aviation sector here by 17 million tons per year. Oh no.
What does that mean?
It means that Sam wants us to do math.
Well, yes. No, that's the whole, it's giving you part of the problem for like a math equation, but it's not giving you the rest of the information that you need to solve it. Like, it's not telling you how much is total or how many are currently active or anything like that.
Yeah. And I think like, when you see a statement like this, it sounds really cool to be like, wow, 17 million tons per year. And it sounds like a lot. But then, like, that's what the point of, like, having that 51 billion tons, like, as a reference, it gives you, like, that other part. Like you said, like, it gives you the total. Right. So do either of you want to attempt to do the math?
I got it. It's, like, 0.03% of, like, total carbon emissions.
Damn. Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
which means that this program referred to in this article only reduced or only reduces emissions 0.03% each year. So like, is that good? Yeah, but like, is it the best?
No.
No.
Is it doing something? Yes. Is it doing what we want? No.
Yeah. And so for context, Bill Gates, he has an energy company called Breakthrough Energy, which invest in sort of like technologies that are like meant to like help the climate. That company, Breakthrough Energy, only funds technologies that could remove at least 500 billion tons a year if successful and fully implemented, which is like roughly 1% of the global emissions.
Better.
Yeah. So Gates writes, technologies that will never exceed 1% shouldn't compete for the limited resources we have for getting to zero. There may be other good reasons to pursue them, but significantly reducing emissions won't be one of them.
Right.
Okay. So I'm gonna put you two to the test again.
Okay, my calculator is ready.
And let's see if we can practice this. So I am sending you an article right now that has, or hopefully has, a highlighted section on it. And I was wondering if one of you could read it for us and for our listeners.
And all right, for reference, on it,
this
following the link.
This article is about like new tech in the energy, the green energy sector.
Are you talking about green cement, the challenge, the tech, and the potential? Because those are highlighted.
That is highlighted. Can you read that for us?
Yes. Okay. So it's talking about green cement, the challenge. The world uses 4 gigatons of cement in construction annually, but it's a hidden carbon villain, requiring limestone to be heated more than 2,700 degrees in a chemical reaction that also releases enormous quantities of CO2. The tech, Solidia has developed a cement that can be fired at lower temperatures, cutting emissions by a third. Its concrete is then cured using CO2 gas, locking the pollutant in the rock, creating carbon reductions of 70%. And the potential, if it were a country, cement would rank third in emissions, 8% of global CO2. If adopted across the industry, Solidia says its technology could lower annual CO2 pollution by 1.5 gigatons and save 3 trillion liters of water.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if I said the company name correctly, but...
We'll link the article in the show notes so anyone can go read it. But let's put this question into practice. This article is talking about like a new sort of production for cement that could like significantly reduce carbon emissions. For reference, a gigaton is 1 billion tons.
Thank you. I don't know what I'm reading.
So how much of the 51 billion tons are we talking about?
1.5 billion tons, essentially.
Yes. And then percentage-wise.
Percentage-wise, I don't know. Like not even percent.
Wait. I got it.
Caitlin, math, you got I'll calculator.
Okay, now we're at like 2.9%.
Yeah.
Yeah. 2%.
Yeah. it's almost math. 3% of annual emissions, which is huge, right? Like that's a significant chunk if it's successful.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And this is actually when I was talking about like a recent development that wasn't addressed in the book. This is it. Gates talks about cement and how we sort of like need to find either like new materials or like a new production method. And this is like, at least in my memory, like this was not referenced in the book. So I think it's like a relatively like recent development in the green space, which is really cool if we could get green cement, right?
Right.
Mm.
I think it's really cool that they're able to lock in the CO2 into the rock, into the cement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. So that was question number one.
Question one. We did it. How did we do, teacher? What's our score?
A+. Gold stars for everyone.
Thank you.
Okay. So are we ready for question number two?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So question number two is, what's your plan for cement?
That's a good question.
So this question is really more of just like a shorthand reminder that when you're talking about a comprehensive plan for tackling climate change, you need to consider everything humans do to contribute to greenhouse emissions.
Mm.
So for the two of you, when you think about the biggest culprits of emissions, what do you think of?
I'm thinking of boats.
Mostly travel, like planes, cars, boats. All them guys.
Yeah. So I was with you. I like both of you. I thought it was travel. But for me personally, I always thought of cars because I think you hear so much about like the carbon footprint of regular gas cars, and like why we all need to switch to electric and hybrid, etc. So in my head, that was like where our main focus should be. But actually, passenger cars only represent less than half of all emissions from transportation, and transportation in general is only 16% of emissions worldwide.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm going to send you. So what I'm going to send you right now is actually in sort of like a graphic from the book. So this is a graphic that shows us sort of like percent by percentage the total emissions from different sectors. Can one of you just sort of like read it for us?
Yeah, sure. So it says how much greenhouse gas is emitted by the things we do. So first one, number one, at 31%, we have making things like cement, steel, plastic. Coming in at number two at 27%, we have plugging in, so using electricity. And then next on our list, number three spot, we have at 19% growing things like plants and animals. Holy crap. Okay. Number four, 16% is getting around, planes, trucks, cargo ships, which, you know, Mo and I thought was number one, but we were way off the mark. And then last in the number five spot at 7% is keeping warm and cool. So heating, cooling, and refrigeration. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you hear about the cars and the transportation the most. So that makes sense that's what we were thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then with like COVID, because, you know, all those things were reduced, there were fewer boats going around and fewer planes flying in the air. Like, you know, the global emissions did drop, I guess, like as they would. But like, you know, I figured it dropped so much because it was more of our total percentage. But not interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I remember reading this and I was, like, shocked that, like, it's, like, making things that is, like, the number one, right? Like, the cement, steel, plastic, yeah.
Plastic. But...
plastic makes – I'm always, like, plastic is the worst. Ugh.
Don't use plastic, friends.
But it makes sense that steel would be a big one because you have to heat the furnaces to ungodly temperatures to melt the metal to begin with.
So in the book, Gates writes, getting to zero means zeroing out every one of these categories. So the question, what's your plan for cement, is just meant to be a reminder that emissions come from five different activities and we need solutions for all of them. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not going to test you on question number two. That was it.
We're safe. But okay. I was listening.
God, I appreciate it. Good. Thanks. Student.
Do I get a sticker for participating in the extra because I volunteered information? No?
Yes. Extra credit, Mo.
Okay. Took it. I'm just kidding.
So, question number three. The third question that Gates outlines in the book is, how much power are we talking about? So this question is really useful when we're talking about electricity, and specifically when we're talking about different sources for electricity, such as wind, solar, nuclear energy plants. Often when you read about these power sources, they tell you how many watts a wind turbine or a solar panel can produce. But without context, that doesn't really mean much. It doesn't really tell us much. Like if I told you that a new power plant would produce 500 megawatts, what do you think that means?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to know. Like, is it a lot? Is it a little? Could that power a house, a city, a state? Like, how much is it exactly?
Right.
So Bill Gates came up with like a handy chart that sort of helps us put these numbers into context. I'm going to send a picture to you. So I'll put it in the Facebook chat again. Okay. It is sent. Can one of you read it?
My turn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this chart is talking about how much power does it take. Coming in at the top at needing 5,000 gigawatts, it's the world.
Wow.
The United States needs 1,000 gigawatts.
Wow.
A mid-sized city needs 1 gigawatt. A small town needs 1 megawatt. Which I'm guessing is 1 million watts. I'm guessing. I don't know. Anyways, and then the average American house needs 1 kilowatt.
Wait. Hold the phone. So this is telling me that the United States uses a fifth of the world's power?
Apparently. Don't quote me on it. Quote Bill Gates.
Okay. Damn, United States. What are you doing?
Get your shit together, bro.
So the important thing to remember from this sort of like section in this question is that basically whenever you hear kilowatt, think house. Mm-hmm. When you hear gigawatt, think city. And when you hear 100 or more gigawatts, think big country.
Gotcha.
Okay.
And then when you hear 1,000, think the United States. Okay, so I'm going to send an article. Can one of you just read the title for me? It is about a new energy source, or not new, but like maybe newish to some of our listeners.
Okay, I'm on it. So it says global ocean energy, tidal stream and wave market to reach 348,100 kilowatts by 2026.
So using tidal energy as your... Yes.
So using like this scale in this like graph or this like infographic, if you will, how much power is that if we're talking about 348,100 kilowatts?
I got a question. 1,000 kilowatts, is it kind of saying like 1,000 million is a billion because British people do that? You know what I mean? So like 1,000 kilowatts is actually a gigawatt. So it's actually 348.1 gigawatts. Is that what they're saying? Am I asking questions that are...
I think you're making it more difficult.
But it's not just 1 kilo, it's 1,000 kilo. Like it's...
Yeah, it's 1,000 kilowatts. So just like look at this infographic. When you hear kilowatt, think house.
Yeah.
If you were to hear 1,000 kilowatts, that's 1,000 houses.
Sorry.
Oh, okay. I got you.
So kilowatt is 1,000 kilowatts. Like, you're like adding more multiplication and division than we need.
I am, but I'm confused. So I'm... Okay. So I'm guessing that it's enough to power almost 350 houses.
So it's 349
or 350,000 houses. So it should be like a small town or something.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a couple mid-sized cities. No? Mid-sized city? Small town? I don't know.
Somewhere in there.
Depends. It depends which country you're in, I guess. Canada, yeah, it's a city.
Like it's enough for like 350,000 houses.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, so that's how question three works.
Sorry.
Hey, man. I'm with Caitlin. Math is not my strong suit, and I was sitting there going, well, how many kilowatts go into a megawatt, and how many megawatts go into a gigawatt, and how many gigawatts go into...
That's my question.
You know, I think there is actually like a chapter on that in the book, but okay. I think just like for like our listeners' sake, we'll just like, if anyone's interested, you can Google it. We won't bore anyone that's not interested.
Fair facts.
Okay. We're going to soon turn this into a math podcast.
Okay. I know if you do Which that, I'm going to have fail. To quit. I'm sorry.
I suck at math, dude.
Today Same. We're going to be looking at this theorem from calculus.
No! Okay.
I did. Okay. I did the calculuses. I barely passed, but I did them.
I finished algebra and I went, okay, cool. Good enough. Got through geometry by the skin.
I almost majored in math.
Oh,
but,
my God.
Crazy person. We're going to leave those days in the past. Okay. So let's move on to our next question. Question number 4, which is, how much space do you need? So this question is also related to energy and power, like the solar, nuclear, you know, wind, whatever. But it's really good for when someone tells you that a certain power source, maybe they're like, oh, solar or like wind or whatever, can supply all the energy the world needs. Mm-hmm. When you hear a statement like that, you need to ask, how much space do you need?
Right. How much acreage do you need for that solar power plant there, bud?
Exactly. Yeah. If someone's like, solar can power, you know, the entire world, be like, okay, but how much space? If someone's like, wind can do it, then you're like, really, how much space? I'm going to send you another handy chart that shows the different watts per square meter. So let me send that in the chat. And can one of you just kind of like describe what you see in this chart?
Okay, so at the top of the chart, it is starts off with how much power can we generate per square meter? And then on the left hand, or fossil fuels will take between 500 to 10,000 watts per square meter, or produce, sorry, produce 500 to 10,000 watts per square meter. My bad. Nuclear will produce between 500 to 1,000 watts per square meter. Solar power will produce between 5 to 20 watts per square meter. Hydropower is between 5 to 50 watts per square meter. Wind is 1 to 2 watts per square meter. Yikes. And wood and other biomasses will produce less than 1 watt per square meter.
Wow.
Oh, and at the bottom it has a little hyphen for solar power. It says power density of solar could theoretically reach 100 watts per square meter, though no one has accomplished this yet.
So what do you notice about the power densities of these power sources?
Well, obviously fossil fuels is number one, but fossil fuel also has this like really huge range.
Right.
Compared to the other ones. The other ones are a little bit tighter. But I guess like the potential is higher than other. But nuclear has the same base, so that's nice. But unfortunately, most of the, like the renewable safe ones are quite low.
Yeah.
One key takeaway. I thought wind would
be a little higher, but.
You thought wind would be higher?
I did. I thought it would be like closer, like more comparable to solar wattage. But.
Yeah, I mean, that was like, that's the one I'd say like key takeaway from this section and from this chart is that solar has a much higher power density than wind. So if you want to use wind to power a town, for example, you'll need a lot more land than you would if you wanted to use solar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, this doesn't mean that like wind is bad and solar is good. It's just one thing to consider, especially in places where maybe there isn't as much space. So like whenever someone is talking about we're going to power like this town or, you know, this country using all of this energy source, you have to ask like, okay, how much space is that going to take? Like, is it feasible space wise?
Yeah. Well, I know in Eastern Washington, as an example, they have started putting in more wind. Like I've seen when I did my road trip in 2021, I saw a lot of wind turbines in Eastern Washington, and that's also partially because they're up on the plains, or not the plains, they're on a plateau, so it's very windy up there all year long. So I can understand them doing that that happening up there, but I was also just like, oh, that's interesting. But then again, also a lot of that area is so arid that it's not really farmable or tillable except for very specific crops, and so there's a lot of unused land anyways.
We got wind power in my hometown too, but we don't keep any of it. We sell it all to the states for some reason. And yeah. And then, but it's also because we don't have any sun.
Actually, I might be able to tell you why you sell it rather than keep it.
Thank you. That would be good.
There's a part of the book where Bill Gates talks about how our like capacity to hold things via battery has basically reached like max innovation. Like there's just not going to be like any significant technological advancements in that field. And so it actually takes really, really, really big batteries to hold like energy. And so that's why things like wind or even solar kind of any like energy source that can be intermittent, where you like don't get it all the time, it's hard to store it. And so like that's why like usually like I'd say like wind turbines, like they like are like creating energy that is then going to be like sent somewhere else because they make so much energy that can't be stored.
Right. Okay.
Or at least not feasibly.
Makes sense.
So somebody needs to invent the newest, coolest battery that can hold a butt ton of power.
Well, that's the thing. Like, we've like maxed out innovation wise. He like goes through it, but he's just like, there's really like no further developments to be made. I think he says like there's like this one like kind of long shot that like probably won't like do anything, and if it is successful, it'll only like cut battery size by like a third or something like that. So it's just like where we are now and where we'll be in the next like probably 20 to 50 years, batteries are going to stay the same size.
Wow.
I wasn't necessarily talking about making them smaller or anything like that. I just meant like more of like their capacity to hold energy.
Yeah, but that's what Sam is saying. We're maxed out.
Yeah.
Unless we develop some kind of like, or not developer, what's the word I'm looking for?
My brother
discover some new material on like an asteroid somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry. That wasn't at you guys. That was at my brother.
Oh.
Yeah. I figured. Okay. So that was question number 4. Are you ready for the last question?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Okay, so the 5th and final question that Bill Gates gives us is, how much is this going to cost?
Good question.
Okay, so I think it's a relatively well-known fact that more often than not, green eco-efficient alternatives are frequently more expensive than their carbon-emitting alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we as a planet have continued to use things like fossil fuels, right? Like when other green alternatives are out there, it's simply cheaper oftentimes to use the carbon emitting version. So this is where the term green premiums comes into play. Have either of you heard this term before?
Green premiums? I mean,
whenever something is a premium, it just means it's kind of more expensive, right? So green premiums, the green version is more expensive.
Yeah, usually. Okay. So green premiums are basically the difference between what you pay for a carbon emitting option versus a zero emitting option. So for example, if we look at the cost of jet fuel, the average cost of a gallon of jet fuel in the United States is currently $2.22. Or at least it was at the time this book was published. I did not look up
I think averages. Right now it's like over $4, dude. It's like, it's crazy.
Gas prices are insane.
Advanced biofuels for jets, which are the greener option, cost on average in 2021, $5.35 a gallon. Oof. So the green premium for zero carbon fuel then is the difference between these two prices, which is $3.13.
Wow.
Okay.
Which is a premium of more than 140%. So it's a pretty lofty premium. In rare cases, green premiums can be negative, which means that the green option is cheaper than the carbon emitting option. And when that happens, the technology is usually widely adopted, or at least on the way to being widely adopted. But in a lot of cases, that's just not what happens, right? The green option is more expensive, I would say 9 times out of 10. The question is, how much more expensive is it? So once we figure out the green premiums for all the big zero carbon options, which like you don't really need to do, like unless you like have an afternoon off and you're like, I'm going to do some like math equations.
That'll never happen.
But like, yeah, if you are working in public policy or investing in green technology, right? This is something that's useful. So once we have those green premiums, we can start having conversations about how much we're willing to pay to go green. And the key to this is that the we is a collective we. So Gates writes, it's not just a matter of what Americans and Europeans can afford. We need premiums to be so low that everyone will be able to decarbonize. And I think that's the key, right? Like we need to be working towards like a place where like it's not just for like people that can afford it, right? We should be making it affordable so that everyone can do it.
Right.
So in general, green premiums are a great tool for making decisions. For example, when you're looking at which zero carbon options we should deploy now, we know that we should be deploying the ones that have low green premiums or no premium at all, just because it's going to be easier for those to be adopted. And if we aren't deploying those, we know that cost isn't the barrier. So if you see something that has a low or like no green premium at all and it's not being deployed, something else is happening, like maybe outdated policies or lack of awareness. And when we're trying to figure out where we should focus our research and development spending, like if you want to invest in green companies, we can focus our resources where green premiums are too high, because that's where the extra cost of going green will keep us from decarbonizing. And that's where there's going to be like an opening for new technology that can make it affordable.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. That sounds like a lot of math.
Yeah, it's a lot of math. I think question number five is more for like if you're actively working in the field. I don't think it's something that you need to necessarily – it's helpful to understand how green premiums work, but I wouldn't worry about too much like calculating them and stuff like
that. Well, I think you could also like – I mean, yeah, anything that you can do large scale, you can do small scale too. Like I think it can be useful for like a household, for example. Like I just switched recently to like bamboo toothbrushes. The bamboo toothbrushes are like a dollar more expensive than the plastic ones. But like, you know, I'm making money now. I'm not a poor college student anymore. But yeah, so but.
And I switched to these fabric softener sheets. So like they're.
Okay. Nice, nice. And even my mom, my mother, because her oil tank is reached the end of its life. So she was looking at like alternative fuel sources. So I think now she's doing like a little bit of thermal or something plus maybe oil together, trying to save herself some money, because in that case, I guess the green premium is negative. So that's kind of interesting.
So those are the five questions.
We did it.
Yay.
A quick recap of them. Number one, it was how much of the 51 billion tons are we talking about? So lots of math. Have fun with that one. Number two, what's your plan for cement? Just consider like all of the five areas of emissions, right? Three, how much power are we talking about? Four, how much space do we need? And five, how much is this going to cost? So we will link an article that Bill Gates wrote for ideas.ted.com. That's basically a condensed version of this chapter that we just discussed. It's a great read, a nice resource to have bookmarked for future use. It has all of the very handy graphics and charts that we talked about, if you want to look at those. So that's it. That is the five questions.
Wow. So yeah, thanks a lot, Sam, for coming on and talking to us about that. I learned a lot and I had to exercise my brain a little bit and use math I haven't used in many, many years. So, but would you recommend this book to anyone?
Yeah. I mean, I would recommend it to everyone. Probably. It's a great read. It's super informative, but also super easy to follow and understand. It's like a really like, I mean, like you're talking about like complex things, but in a very like
layman's term.
Accessible way. Exactly. It's the type of book I recommend purchasing in some form if you can, because I think you're probably going to want to come back to it over and over again. Like I know our listeners can't see, but like I don't know if Mo and Caitlin, you can see like I have like post-it notes like highlighted, like my entire book is like I've gone back to it like at least three times. So definitely recommend.
Nice. Yeah. And if you guys listening in like this episode as much as we did, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe, share, whatever it is. It really helps us out and makes our podcast grow. And I'm so happy that Sam was on this episode and I learned.
I know. Yeah. It was nice to be reunited.
The trifecta. Ah.
The trifecta of glory.
Yes.
Oh my God. I love that. Next podcast idea.
We're just going to talk about how great the three of us together are.
Oh my God,
we're scrapping our like name. We're no longer Get Over It. We are the trifecta of glory.
Oh my God.
This is so good. Oh, no wonder you're a literary major. My God.
Yeah. So, and then for our listeners too, we also have a Patreon. Become a Patreon member and you can get access to behind the scenes content, AMAs and more. Link in the description.
Also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for additional content.
So thanks again, Sam, for coming on. Don't be a stranger now. And to our listeners, see you next month.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye. That's it for today, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in.
And as always, please support this work by subscribing and donating to our cause at www.teamgetoveryit.com.
Donors get access to specific content like stickers, t-shirts, and postcards from our journey.
You can donate for as little as $5 and the benefits build from there.
Go to our website for more info or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Team Get Over It.
Thanks for listening and catch us next time on Get Over It.